Count your blessings. Have you ever heard that saying? I think a very valuable reminder of this idiom, this expression, a very valuable reminder at a time when we can easily get overwhelmed by negativity and all the atrocities and war and cruelty that is happening in the world. I felt reminded of that saying yesterday in this beautiful full moon night when we had a little bit of rain. It's called the rainy season retreat because in ancient India, or even in India nowadays, that's the time of the rainy season. Here at Dhammagiri is actually the dry season or rainy season retreat. But quite auspiciously, we had some rain just when we started the rasa. And we also had some rain just 2 days ago. And I think that rain had taken out all the dust, a little bit of smoke from a few fires nearby. And we had this exceptional clear air and this super bright moon. I checked, it wasn't actually a super moon or anything, but it subjectively appeared really, really bright and radiant. I couldn't walk under the covered walking path without requiring any light. You can see shadows and it's so bright and you can even guess some colors. And then walking away, and I had cooled down, but not too cool. And just reflecting about the blessing and the benefit of being able to live that kind of life as a monk, to have that kind of conditions for bhavana, to have a kuti and that kind of location, to have friends in the holy life like Ajahn Munay or Ajahn Kantiko, being able to stay together with real friends in the Dhamma, Gavi and Peter, the two laymen who were staying with us in the Vasa. It's really amazing to have that. And then the support. Sometimes to me it's almost a small miracle. I mean, being able to have that lifestyle in that beautiful natural environment, when I look out from my kuti, I'm looking towards the north, and sometimes I can't see a single light, although I have a very wide view because I'm looking directly towards Dagilar National Park to the north, the rolling hills. We are 160 meter high on top, and then the rolling hills go up to about the 700 meter Mount Nebo, Mount Glorious. And that's what I'm overlooking. The only thing, the light usually on that side is one flight path, which is to the north of Dagilar National Park. I usually go along there when I come back from Asia, from Singapore, Bangkok and so on. By so far that I just see the lights in the distance, but I can't hear anything at all. It's too far away. Then it's nothing. And that is only the 45 minutes drive from the city center of Brisbane. You all know the encouragement of the Buddha to stay in the present moment. And sure enough, for deepening samadhi or to develop a liberating insight, that will be impossible if the mind is wandering in the past and into the future. But the teaching of the present moment shouldn't be misunderstood, that one can live one's whole life totally only being in the present moment. That is not possible. And from time to time, one has to do some skillful planning for the future, and from some time to time, it is also beneficial to reflect on the past, to learn something, or to develop the quality which we call mudita, sympathetic joy, which we call anumodana, rejoicing, which we also call gratitude, and noticing how much we actually have to be grateful for. A grateful person is not just someone who expresses the gratitude and what they have received. No, the first step is simply becoming aware that there is something to be grateful for. And we are often trained to complain, to find things which are not good, and for sure we can all find that. Not trying to look at the world with pink glasses and going into denial, and I'm totally aware what a miserable place and how much outright atrocities and war are happening. But if we always focus on that, now our mind can start thinking, we become depressed and discouraged, embittered. So occasionally it is so important to count our blessings, to develop gratitude and mudita for the good things we have. And yesterday at the end of this rainy season retreat, it came quite natural to me to just be stunned and awed that this lifestyle is still possible in the 21st century in a non-Buddhist country, and if we are small minorities, only 2.5% Buddhists in Australia, even less than the Theravada. And if you look at the state of the world, now how would you practice if you are in Ukraine, in Donbas, getting rockets and artillery slammed onto you, or being drafted into the army and suddenly finding yourself in an earth hole and being bombed by drones and artillery and having to fight for your survival when the others come running at you and so on. Now in Gaza right now, there's so many places, and that in this kind of world, commercialization, everyone only after profit and getting money and materialism. I'm not denying any of that. Attitude of counting your blessing and anumodana is not a denial, and it's not saying these bad things don't exist. Everything is fine. We are all nice little teddy bears and unicorns and everyone is loving each other. And that would be denial. That's not the case. But both these things exist. And we have to gauge the state of our mind, which one we should be paying attention to. And if our mind is already angry and upset and maybe slightly depressed, and then just to pay attention to all the details in an awful war, that will usually not lead to real letting go. Before contemplating dukkha quite intensively, the mind needs a certain basis in samadhi, a certain level of maturity in the faculties. And even when that is there, anyone can't do that all the time. And even the great Kuba Ajahns, when they describe their practice at a very advanced state, they would contemplate. And of course, if you really develop insight, you have to look at dukkha and impermanence and disappointment. But then they would rest the mind in samadhi. And samadhi is a state of the most intense and refined forms of bliss and rapture. Or maybe an equanimity if it's very deep, which even goes beyond bliss and rapture. And then they come out and then they can face it again. However, I think many people nowadays are glued to their devices and the media and following the disasters and wars and atrocities happening. Now their mind is usually not in a state that looking at so much dukkha and so much disappointing stuff that it would lead to letting go and deep insight. Other way around, the first deep insight, and then as a result of deep insight, letting go. But the people get riled up, get angry, or they get depressed or hopeless. If we notice that in our mind, without denying anything, we can acknowledge these things exist. But if we notice, now this is now just driving our mind down, then it's the time to start reflecting, counting our blessings. When I ordained in Sri Lanka many years ago, I noticed I have an anniversary, 25 vasa in Australia now. I spent 25 rain retreats in Australia. So more than 25 years ago, practicing in Sri Lanka, every evening we would do this recitation, Dullabho Manusapati Labho. It is difficult to attain a human rebirth. Sometimes people feel there's nothing really to count blessings in my life, and I only have so much trouble and difficulties and so much hardship. Now, what could I be grateful for? Now, you're a human being. And in the wider scheme of things, now, that is very rare. Now, how many years have human beings been living on this earth? 200 million years or something, maybe a dinosaurs. And human beings for whatever 100,000 years, according to modern science. I'm not sure how correct that is, but I think a couple of hundred thousand years. We compare that to 200 million years of dinosaurs. Now, how many ants are there? How many worms and so on compared to human beings? So it is a rare and special opportunity. That's one reflection. If you don't know how to start, my life is so tough and miserable. What can I count as a blessing? That certainly is a blessing. And it gets even better because we are born as a human being at a time when the teaching of the Buddha is still available. We may not, in this life, we have not met the Buddha. I mean, that is exceedingly rare that you have that kind of parami, that you're born when the Buddha is actually walking around and teaching. But even then, if the Buddha's teaching is still around and we have confidence, the faith, conviction in the teaching, that is actually better than meeting the Buddha and maybe having not faith in him. Even when the Buddha was walking on this earth, don't know exactly the percentage, but the majority of people in India may not even have had faith in him at that time. So being born as a human and at a time when the teaching of the Buddha is available, the sasana, and not just the teaching, the infrastructure, there are still no great ajahns. These have passed away. But Lungpo Liam is alive, Lungpo Tongdeng is alive, we had them here this year. That kind of being are still in existence. Now, there are good monasteries. There's opportunities to go on retreat, to even ordain, to live as monks and nuns. And if you have faith and these opportunities are there, born as a human being, sasana, now this is basically the jackpot in the lotto. Even just a human being is already a lotto win. And additionally, in having faith in the teaching at a time when they are available, the Buddha Dhamma leading to Nibbana, that is basically the jackpot. And a really nice forest monastery is on top of that, and icing on the cream, an icing on the cake as a cream. The crop is the very best. And it was beautiful, walking on my simple walking path, but with these kind of views and looking back now on 3 months. I'm sometimes surprised that we don't have a waiting list with hundreds of names of people who want to come for retreat, or monks wanting to stay, and people wanting to ordain. Is such a beautiful life, and people are willing to come every single day, and you just had the food. We have that. Now, Sunday is a bit more than weekdays now, but basically we have every day, you know, that kind of dedicated food. We just had Alex visiting, and he used to be the attendant monk, the Upatak of Lungpo Liem for many years. And he later disrobed, also due to health reasons. And recently he had a really big operation, which only one doctor was even willing to take on. And he was lucky, and he pulled through, and then he came here for a visit. And one thing he mentioned, he was so happy when someone came and offered him additional food in hospital, because the food is not really very good. And he also remembered, and we talked about that, he said, when he was a monk, and he received this food, which is given as dana, that it seems to have a different kind of quality. And I was intrigued by that, because I had the same feeling. Now, one is the material base of the food. Now, that will be the same, wherever you get that from. But I remember one lady I know, when they come to offer food here, there's a real big event, and she is meditating, and she is playing the Pavetta chanting while she is preparing the food, and she keeps her mind really focused. That is maybe a little bit more than most people do, but there's always this very wholesome intention of doing that as an act of generosity, of doing that as an act of supporting the Sangha, making good karma by maintaining the organization, the people who have transmitted the Dhamma for 2.5 millennia. And I honestly believe that there is something in the food when you eat that, which is different. And even if you go to a 3-Michelin-star restaurant or a 5-star hotel, the people working there, they may actually be not happy, and on that day they would love to stay home because they have problems or they're a little bit sick. And then they go there and they just cook because it's their work, and they do it for money. So I think that you can't get that particular quality in the food. And to me, I think one can somehow notice that. And I was intrigued that he also noticed that, particularly when he was really weak and very exhausted from that sickness and the big operation. And to live a life where that comes every day. Don't even have to think about food. Just come here and that quality of food is offered. I'm sometimes surprised why people are not trying to get in even just for the food and a nice life, but apparently they don't do it. And then being able, usually going back in the afternoon, having quiet time. Of course, the kutis, the little bit ugly ducklings, it's just these metal demountable donga. But in that environment where it's put, I'm exceedingly happy there. I honestly haven't met a single abbot yet where I would wish to swap kutis. Many have actually much nicer kutis, cabins, much bigger and so on, but location, in real estate, it's all location, isn't it? It's location, and in terms of location, I honestly haven't seen a single one where I would want to swap. Although it's only a metal box. I mean, it wouldn't work. Now, in Germany, you couldn't live in that kind of thing. It's too cold and so on, or in England. And a lot is the weather. I wouldn't want to be in that metal box in English November or something. That would be something different, but here it's just perfect. There's a famous statement from, I think it was a philosopher, was it Kierkegaard? The hell is other people. That's what he said. I think it's also true for heaven. If you consider what really makes the quality of your life and nothingness really the people you have around you and the people you interact with. And sometimes people, if they have their loved ones with them, they would be willing to face almost any hardship, any kind of climate or even war, rather than being in the presidential suite in the Hilton, completely isolated, never being allowed to meet anyone. On the other hand, like prison, American prison, or if you read from people who have had that experience, it's just very tough to live with that kind of people together. So it's good to occasionally reflect and count the blessing of what kind of persons we are able to associate with and to have contact with. And again, one can have an attitude of complaining, and of course, fully awakened Arahants who are freed from defilements, they are quite rare nowadays. And if we have a fault-finding mind, we may find fault even with the Arahants and complain about whatever idiosyncratic character traits they still have. It's not like they lose all their character traits, only the defilements are gone. But they can be very different and have certain vasana-inhabited tendencies from lifetimes. If it's not exactly a defilement, then you may not like that. But below that level, obviously everyone has their shortcomings and drawbacks and kilesas. But if we look at the bright side, the good qualities from people we know and interact with, at least yesterday when I did that, you feel there's so much to appreciate and to be grateful for. Maybe I have a bit better situation than many others. I live together with monks, and this year we had senior monks and two laymen who were willing to give it the whole Vains retreat and even longer. Or Gabby 2 months, and now he's staying another month, is also more than 3 months. Now that is probably a noticeably higher standard than what you meet out in the world. But still, if we are willing to look and recognize good qualities in people we know, I think we can find a lot. Otherwise, get ordained. And then you're in a sangha. And although that's not like I think they're all totally fantastic and enlightened, but if you compare it with what's going out there in the world, there's pretty decent people there. It's a huge privilege to be part of that. Ajahn Muneyu pointed out to me, we have 3 Western monks hitting 50 Vains retreat this year. 3 Canadian, curiously, Ajahn V, Ajahn Tivadamo, Lumpa Pasano. I mean, in Asia and in traditional Buddhist countries, you have many monks, but among Western monks, they're still quite a rare club. Germany is doing fairly fine, not so much recently, but I can remember at least 4 monks and also 1 nun who lived in Sri Lanka who made it to at least 50 vasan. So it's a huge benefit, and I feel very happy to be able to be part of that sangha and in a very good tradition, the forest tradition, Lumpa Cha, and all the associated monasteries. Again, not perfect, but if you look at the good side, a lot to be grateful for, a lot of blessings. And then I have this Vinaya of the Buddha, which the longer you live, and now it's 28 vasa as a monk, the longer you live with these rules, the more you notice how unbelievably wise and beneficial they are, and that a lot of the supreme wisdom of the Buddha comes out not only in the Dhamma, which is usually more known in the lay community, but also in the rules of discipline that the Buddha has given us. some have effects and you don't immediately recognize. One which always strikes me is not having money. That may sound quite scary, and if you're in lay life, the idea of not having any money is probably a rather frightening one for you. It was also frightening for me when I started this, or was researching for this PhD, which I wanted to do in India. And then I felt, no, I take so much effort and mental engagement and so on. I want to really live the spiritual life 100%. I haven't even fully encountered the Dhamma at that stage. No, I wasn't really a Buddhist, I'd taken refuge. So it was more like a diffuse idea of meditating in the Himalayas. And I thought, now how do I do that? Now how do I survive? I had some money at that time, but it would some stage run out. And then my parents are not millionaires, and don't want to have them. They're just financing you and agonizing. But for the last 28 years, that was the least problem. There's so much support, and people are so happy to support monks. Amazing. Huge blessing. And I see so many benefits in not having money. And one big benefit is, once people know that, is an incredible filter. Because everyone who just wants money or other material benefits from me, they know that they're not getting that. They will not approach me, they will not even come here. It's like having a really super smart, mind-reading bouncer at the gate there. Because even if you're super rich and you pay for the top bouncers for your parties or whatever you're doing there, how would these people know? You will not even know yourself. If you're really rich, the big problem is that probably virtually everyone who tries to associate with you and is after the money. It's one big problem that rich people have. They can only rely maybe on old friends who they know from the time before they were rich, or maybe on other people who are super rich so that they're not really so keen on getting more money from them or anything. But this kind of situation, that people who are egoistic, stingy, materialistic, who just want to get money, that they just don't come. I'm totally uninteresting for them. I can't get that from monks. And I have that around me continuously all the time. And when I travel, because I don't have money, they usually pick me up at the airport someone, and I tend to meet some of the best people in that town or that city, straight at the airport. Maybe not in the so-called high society in worldly terms, or the richest or the most famous, but in heart qualities, usually vastly above average, often very, very good people, and the moment I arrive, and then it continues like that all the time. There's a huge blessing now I'm thinking about. That comes from the words the Buddha has given us. And the greatest thing is having opportunities for developing bhavana. Now for sure we have to train ourselves to cultivate the Eightfold Path in all situations, even when we are busy or working, when we are having social interaction, when you're doing emails or shopping, or cooking, having meetings in your job and so on. But still, in particular for developing the samadhi and advanced insight, the external conditions are important. And I felt a strong sense of gratitude and more appreciation that we have a community who was willing to let go and then sell a very comfy suburban vihara where people can get much quicker and easily, and start a forest monastery where access is a bit more difficult, longer drive, but where one has the air of seclusion, where one has what the Buddha called viveka, Eka Vihari, in the dwelling alone. Pantantra Sayanasanang, in the Ovada Patimokkha, in a secluded resting place. And of course, and it takes much more effort and money and more difficult. If you just buy in a kind of house, three-floor house in the suburb, you can put 20 monks in there, you know, on a small property, and then each has their own room. Would be much easier to organize and so on than having kutis on the hill in nature. But if you're walking in the corridor of a three-floor house in the full moon night, or if you're walking like me yesterday on that timber walking path overlooking the national park, you have no doubts in your mind what's the difference and which one is more conducive to meditation. Really outstanding, even here at this Dhamma hall, you have quite a bit of that feeling. Actually, in Sri Lanka, after the crisis in the Sasana in the first century, when they had war and occupation and famine and so on, sickness, that's when they first were writing down the Tipitaka. It was on that occasion because they suddenly noticed that one particular part of the scriptures, they could find only one monk who could remember it by heart. And he was a very difficult, cranky and impolite, not very well behaved old monk. And even the very learned Mahathevas had to wheedle him because he had to teach them that particular scripture. He was the only one who still knew it fully by heart. That was the final trigger, and then they decided they have to write it down. But another thing which happened around the same time was a reorganization of many monasteries, and they started the courtyard structure. Now that is like three sides, like a letter U, with a building where the monks have their cells, a central courtyard, and then the vihara on the open side of the U, which is much easier to maintain. But obviously, you're lacking seclusion. This is much better than living in a high-rise building, but it's obviously no longer these kutis. Having single kutis for every single monastic practitioner is obviously a huge effort. And if you want to have them secluded, you need a large area and have to put them separate by quite a bit. But this is the original lifestyle the Buddha encouraged. And we can have that here in Australia in 21st century, when you have things like Donbas War, and you have Gaza, and you have capitalism and monopolies and exploitation. I don't know. I mean, all the bad stuff we have, but we do have that. And it's almost like a little miracle and a big source of joy and happiness for me, and feelings of appreciation, anumodana, sympathetic joy, rejoicing, mudita. And I like to express that to all of you for that support. 25 years here in Australia, 25 asa. Big anumodana to you all.